Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, things happening in the arts, from brothers Clive and Graham Pohl on architecture as public art, and Jeff Sachs, the new managing director at Lexington Children's Theater, to some brand new music from the Frankfurt recording duo Greg Lind and Matt Page, and details of a coming Green Room Exchange concert fusing the music of India with jazz and world music. But first, the art of raising chickens in your backyard. And is that a good idea? Here's our contributor on all things animal, Natalie Voss.
I'm here with Dr. Jackie Jacob, who is an agricultural extension project manager at the University of Kentucky, specializing in UK's poultry program. Dr. Jacob, I'm sure you have heard from many people in recent weeks and months who are concerned about the price of eggs, the availability of eggs amidst the avian flu outbreak that's happening right now. And I at least am hearing from a lot of people who are saying, you know, I'm just going to get my own flock of backyard chickens. What is your reaction when people say that to you as something of an expert on chickens?
I get a little concerned if they haven't given it enough thought. They need to know if they are allowed to have backyard flocks. A lot of them think they can do it no matter what, but homeowners associations override any county or city regulations. If you don't have a homeowners association, then contact your extension office to see if you're allowed. Cooperative extension is part of the land grant universities, which University of Kentucky is, to supply research-based information to anyone, really, on anything. They do cooking, agriculture, 4-H, all sorts of things. So if they've given it enough thought, then, you know, I ask, why are you doing it? If you think you can produce eggs cheaper than the store, you'll be sadly, you know, disappointed because you can't. I mean, you have to get the chicken house, you have to get the equipment, you have to buy the feed. If you buy chicks, you have to buy 6 by state law. You have to raise them up for 16 to 18 weeks, depending on what breed they are, before they're going to give you any eggs. So, you know, maybe by then the problem will be yours. And then what are you going to do when the egg prices go back down again? Are you going to keep them? Are you going to abandon them? Are you going to eat them? I mean, you know, you have to think about all this. If they've given it enough thought, then I'll help them out. But
what is the first thing that people should consider? If you say this to them and they say, well, I've always liked chickens, or I, you know, my parents had chickens when I was young, I still think that I want chickens. What is the first thing they need to be thinking about?
They need to be thinking about the time commitment. Poultry, chickens, whatever, are animals. They need to be taken care of every day, 365 days a year. If you're going to want to go on holidays or whatever, you need to have someone that's going to be able to take care of the birds, especially if they're egg laying, because you don't want to leave the eggs outside, especially in the summer. It's a commitment. It's a financial commitment. It's a time commitment. It's same types of things you should think about before you get pets.
Say someone lives in a suburban or urban area. They've done their diligence, they've checked the local codes or their HOA regulations and found that they can have chickens. What do they need to think about when they look out into their backyard? What sort of housing situation do I need to have to keep chickens safely? Because chickens can get eaten by things quite easily. So they can't just kind of hang out in your yard and abide by the dog fencing and be fine.
Yeah. If you're in an urban, suburban area, I highly recommend that the housing be a confinement housing so that you're not having the chickens run around in your backyard. There's a couple of reasons for that, because chickens poop. And if they're running around in your backyard, then anytime you want to use your backyard, it's going to be covered in chicken poop, which, one, makes you dirty, but two, also can make you sick if you get contaminated by salmonella, which can be in their poop. Every year we get outbreaks of salmonella, human salmonella, and they're all traced back to backyard flocks. So when you're looking out, make sure you have room for a confinement for the number of birds you want. The confinement should have an outdoor run so that they can go outside and do some of their natural behaviors. And then will it leave you enough backyard to do whatever it is you want to do? You don't want to be too close to your neighbors, especially if you're going to have roosters, and some places do allow roosters. Lexington does. And think about where you're going to get rid of your manure. So typically we recommend composting. So do you have an area for composting? You can combine that with your kitchen waste as well to have a composting program, and make sure you know how to take care of the birds.
Yeah. What are some things that people should think about as far as bird care? I mean, I'm not horribly familiar with chickens, but I know they're not quite like a dog or a cat as far as what they need from you or how they're going to interact with you.
Well, we have a lot of fact sheets on our website. The Department of Animal and Food Sciences website has a poultry section, and we have a lot of different fact sheets for specifically small backyard flocks, what breed to get, what kind of housing, what to do with your manure, how to compost your manure, how to store your feed so you're not attracting rodents, what predators to look out for. I mean, it's pretty much everything there. Why have your hens stopped laying eggs? All that kind of stuff. So I recommend they look at some of those before they get started.
And you bring up an interesting point, which is that hens don't lay eggs all the time, all year round, and they don't necessarily lay eggs for their whole lives. So how should people be thinking about that if they want to, you know, just pick up a couple of cute chicks from Tractor Supply or something and bring them home? What does the rest of that bird's life look like as far as when they are and are not going to be laying eggs?
Well, it depends on your relationship with the chickens. First off, you have to buy six. The state law requires that you buy six because they are flock animals. You know, they don't like to be alone. So for animal welfare issues, you have to have at least six. Then you have to raise them up for 16 to 18 weeks before they start laying. So you're feeding them and getting nothing. You need to have brooding set up because they can't control their body temperature for the first few weeks. So they can't go outside into the poultry house. You have to have a brooding area. They will come into production with increasing day length, and they go out of production with decreasing day length. So if you're getting them when days are getting shorter, it will take longer for them to actually come back into production. If you get them when days are getting longer, you're more likely to have them come into production at a reasonable time. If you don't supply supplemental light, then when the days start getting shorter, they're going to go out of production again. So if you can maintain light in the poultry house for 14 hours a day, they will lay through the winter. So then you'll get eggs most of the time. They'll go into production and peak so that everybody in the flock is laying, and then slowly they'll start laying less and less every day until they get to a point where, you know, they need a break. And they'll stop laying, and they'll molt their feathers, grow new ones, and then they'll start all over again. Typically, you get a reasonable amount of eggs, depending on the breed that you have, for 3 or 4 years, maybe 5, depending on the breed. And then after that, of course, they stop producing any number of eggs. They make one every once in a while or so. But you have to decide, you know, are you a farmer and you're going to eat the chickens that are not laying anymore and make some chicken stew, or are they pets? And then you have to keep feeding them even if they're not giving you anything in return except for companionship. So, yeah, they don't lay all year round and they don't lay forever. They can live 10 to 12, 15 years depending on the breed, how much they've been laying, how they're managed, how they're fed, and whether or not they get eaten by predators.
Now, you mentioned people who think of their chickens more as companions, which is might seem a little strange to someone who's never had one before. But we were talking before this interview about one kind of important caution. If you end up keeping your chickens as pets, maybe don't put them real close to your face. Why is that?
Especially a problem with kids who like to kiss and snuggle baby chicks, sometimes even the adult chickens. Chickens are livestock. They have salmonella in their poop, and it can get onto their feathers and, you know, different things like that. And if you have it close to your face, it can get into your eyes, it can get into your mouth, and then you get sick. There are many, many different types of salmonella. Not all of them make you sick, but you risk getting sick if you have it close to your face where you could get, you know, some contamination. And you could be, get it if you handle the birds a lot and don't wash your hands afterward. Again, you could ingest some of the bacteria and get sick.
Thank you so much for these wonderful considerations for people if they decide to start a backyard flock. They know who to go to now.
Yeah, that's my job.
Under Maine's Art Sheckett is here with a pair of guests who see in architecture opportunities to weave public art into a city's built environment.
Welcome, Graham and Clive Pohl, to Eastern Standard. Thanks for visiting with us. And today, we're going to talk about a project that your firm, Pohl Rosa Pohl, designed for downtown Lexington. But before we do that, I want to talk to each of you briefly about what drew you to the field of architecture. Graham, you want to take a shot at it?
I worked in state government in Frankfurt for 8 years and got increasingly interested in public facilities and sort of became the agency expert who could look at maps and drawings and understand them, and ultimately got to a point where I wanted to get more creative with my work, but also enjoyed the technical aspect. So I went back to school and got a master's in architecture.
What about you, Clive?
For me, my story is not terribly dissimilar from Graham's. I was looking to strike a balance between making a living and offering a practical service with being an artist, because I knew that spiritually I was somewhere in the middle there. And so that's what architecture has been for me, is traversing that territory between those two poles or those two paradigms.
A number of years ago, your firm, Pohl Rosa Pohl, designed a project for the Lexington Parking Authority, a facade or a treatment of the facade of a undistinguished building, to say the least. Maybe ugly would even be better to call it, right in the middle of downtown Lexington. And it's recently been featured in a glossy magazine that's published in South Africa but gets quite an international readership, that focused on architectural lighting treatments of different buildings. And the Helix Garage treatment that you guys designed was featured in that. How did this project come to you and how did it develop?
I guess that's a long story, but ultimately we were asked to develop three schemes for the parking authority, and they ended up selecting one of those schemes. At the time, Adam Weissman was a key employee with us, and he was very much involved in the design process and execution of the work. As you described, that building was really an eyesore, and now I think it's something people look for, and that's what they were looking for. They just wanted to improve the branding, I guess, of their facilities, and they've continued that work.
Yeah, and at the time we had a mayor who overtly advocated for good urban design.
This was Mayor Jim Gray.
Mayor Jim Gray was a huge advocate, and not only for Lexington, but for us. Wouldn't you say, Graham, in the mix?
Yeah.
He was an essential component part and very involved, and I think raised the bar with respect to the final outcome on several occasions in the design process. He was a huge, huge help.
He did. In fact, at the time, Mayor Gray was pushing hard for relaxing some of the signage rules, limitations, so that we could get a little more pizzazz in our signage. And he actually reviewed the sign design personally, from what I understand. And I think he rejected our first one. And I can't remember exactly what happened there, but I know that he had a hand in...
Wasn't it to do with the two-way, the proposition that Main Street would become a two-way?
Oh, it could be.
It seems to me that that was a big part of the conversation. He came to a number of meetings around that time, too.
Did the parking authority know at all what they were looking for?
It was the board that interviewed us, and, you know, so it was a group of people, and they had pretty strong opinions and pretty strong desires. But I think they were looking for stuff that was out of the box, which is probably why we were brought in, because that's kind of always been our shtick, you know.
So for listeners that aren't familiar with the project, maybe you could describe briefly how the project evolved and what it became and what it is at currently.
Part of the timing of it, in fact, was attached to the technological evolution of LED lighting, which not too many years before that had begun to be more affordable. And so this is in part why that project is one of the first of its kind in downtown Lexington and elsewhere that engaged that technology, that computer-controlled, changeable colors, programmable systems. They'd been around, but not terribly affordably for very long. And so the Helix Garage is a series of stainless steel panels that are three deep and in various relation to one each layer and each panel. So different shapes and different meshes that play with the light.
So during the day, people just drive by or walk by and they see the steel panels sort of interconnected with each other. And then at night, the lighting, the show.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So what you used to look at was a series of concrete trays, typical parking garage, which was really brutal. So there was no sort of humanity there. So the panels are perforated stainless steel, and they float out in front of those concrete trays. So the concrete trays have sort of receded into the background. You just don't even notice them. And the perforations in the panels are varied to allow various amount of light to come through. And then the LED strips are around the perimeter of the panel so that the panel seems to glow. And the light source is actually invisible. It's the reflections that play across the perforations that you actually see.
Mm-hmm. And the colors can be sequenced in different ways?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And in fact, you know, one of my fondest memories from the very early days of its first illumination, I may be wrong about that, was it was all purple to celebrate the passing of Prince. A proud moment for Lexington, in my opinion.
Well, it certainly changed the look of that part of downtown Lexington. Was that something that came into your thinking in designing this project, how it would relate to the surroundings in that block and further?
Yes is the short answer. I think, quite honestly, Art, whenever we take on a design proposition, it's always to do two things. Even with residential design, there is a component that must remain responsible to the neighborhood, and there's a component that is unique to the individual and does not have that kind of social responsibility. But certainly that's central to, I think, Jim Gray's intent for the project. And the Lexington Parking Authority wanted to improve the view of them as being a little more visionary than just, you know, citing people for parking violations. They did have visionary leadership at that time, no question.
So it really was kind of an intervention into a built urban environment. And I'd like to talk just a little bit about that, how architecture and design can impact already built environment rather than one that you're developing from scratch. How does that work? What does an architect think about when they're doing an intervention like what you guys did with the Helix Garage?
The Helix Garage project is not the best example from which to address that question because it's an applique on an existing facility, and it was limited because the police station occupied the first level. So we couldn't bring it down to the ground, which was a bit frustrating and a challenge because, you know, we wanted it to feel like it was right for the place, but not being able to bring it to the ground was quite a limitation. So typically you're able to address an urban condition from scratch. And in this case, it was making something that felt right in terms of its scale, in terms of its weight. And there's a piece of it which is pretty critical that most people would never really think much about, but it actually turns a corner. Because as you're looking at it from the east, you actually see the corner of the structure that it's applied to. And so it actually turns the corner. And so little moves like that make a huge difference because it gives it this sense of volume that it otherwise wouldn't have. It would just look like this sort of planar applique. But with the turning the corner, it actually has this feeling of being a volume. And those kinds of moves are important.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's always a desire when introducing new ideas and new technologies to existing buildings that they should be sympathetic. So it's often a balancing act between a symbiosis between old and new, and at the same time setting the bar a little higher than the original may have.
You know, we've had our share of controversies for sure in Lexington about proposed projects in the urban core. And often citizens, as we are bound to do, have very strong opinions about things. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for the ordinary layperson who's not an architect or a design professional about how to evaluate a proposed project. Because we have several that are actually going to be happening over the next several years, like across from Rupp Arena. How should a citizen evaluate the merit of a proposed development in architecturally and in terms of design?
For me, in all things design, I really look for clarity and simplicity. What hobby horses tend to do in the design realm is tchotchke things up with trim and too much of this and additive stuff. And almost invariably, for me at least, a subtractive approach is preferable because it does lead to simplicity. And despite what one might intuit, simplicity is not as easy as complexity to achieve in design.
Graham, you have some thoughts?
I would say that some things to look for are issues of scale. Does the piece look like it feels right in the space relative to the context, the stuff around it? Issues of edge. Does the piece make an edge that helps to define the public space? So if you think about the street as a public space, is the edge being made by this new piece consistent with other stuff in such a way that it helps to clarify the public space that it's addressing? Materials, forms, are they sympathetic? And if they're not sympathetic, is their deviation from the context something that one understands and can appreciate? And I guess the last thing I would say is that new architecture should speak about the era in which it's built. It should not be pretending to be from another era. It can make reference to that. It can feel right with that. But it really should be quite clear about its own era.
Well, Graham Pohl and Clive Pohl, we really appreciate you talking to us. Congratulations on the Helix project. It's been out there now for quite a while, but it continues to receive accolades and notice, which I think speaks to how strong that work really is and how it stands the test of time. So thanks again for coming and talking with us on Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Art.
Coming up after the break, new leadership at Lexington Children's Theater, new music from a countryside studio near Frankfurt, and an international musical stew slow cooking for a June concert at the Downtown Arts Center. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. This is a WEKU history moment. History worth hearing. When WEKU powered up our 50,000-watt transmitter on October 7, 1968, it started a long and rich partnership with Kentuckians. Heralded as the most powerful educational station in the Commonwealth, WEKU's original mission was to bring Eastern's message of vision, industry, and integrity to other parts of the state while appealing to a wide variety of tastes. We've continued that commitment for seven decades. Help WEKU continue making history. Join our 1850 campaign. We need 1,850 supporters to give $10 a month and strengthen the station for the future. Find out how you can support us online at weku.org. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Joining us here in the studio is Jeff Sachs. Jeff is the new managing director at Lexington Children's Theater. He has relocated to Lexington after serving as the founding manager director of Kerfuffle, a theater for the very young in Chicago. Jeff got his bachelor's in theater from Northwestern, a master of fine arts in theater for youth from Arizona State, and he got his MBA from DePaul. Welcome, Jeff.
It's good to be here.
So this is a return to Kentucky for you, is that right?
That's right. I started my professional life through an internship at Actors Theater of Louisville. I was the education and teaching artist intern there from 2013 to 2014. And in that year, I really fell in love with the idea of radical hospitality that I was coming across in Kentucky. The theater that we were making in Louisville, the way that it served the community and also kind of made its own impact on the national scene, I always knew that I wanted to come back to a community like Kentucky.
So how did Lexington happen?
So Lexington Children's Theater is a theater that I've had my eyes on since I went to the American Alliance for Theater and Education Conference in Lexington in 2012. That was maybe my first, you know, professional conference. And that's how I learned about what was going on there, the great work that had been happening with Larry and Vivian Snipes. And when I saw the opening, this opportunity to work at that theater and put together my MFA, my MBA, all that experience and bring it back to a community like Lexington, I knew that that was an opportunity I had to pursue. I think that was the only job I applied to that wasn't in Chicago for over a year. Fate told me it was time to come back to Kentucky.
Have you been able to kind of get a sense of the community, the vibe here? How would you describe it?
I would describe the vibe in Kentucky, or in Lexington specifically, as very welcoming. I've received so many emails and messages from people who are invested in the Lexington Children's Theater and want to connect with me and share with me what is happening in their community and what Lexington and the theater means to them. And so it's an exciting time to be at the theater and to be joining that community that's been so welcoming.
So tell us about your responsibilities as a managing director of a children's theater.
So I'm responsible for keeping the boat afloat, for making sure we've got all the resources that we need. So that's keeping all the bookkeeping in order, taking care of marketing and getting our message out there, and also development and fundraising. Right now, it's the end of our fiscal year, so I'm tying up all the odds and ends of making sure we've got all our I's dotted and our T's crossed, and I'm looking forward to the next fiscal year, in which we'll be presenting 9 plays and educational classes for children all across Kentucky.
Is it the role of the managing director to kind of come up with a plan or a vision for the future, or is that more on the board level? How does that work?
That's a great question. So I collaborate primarily with the producing artistic director, Jeremy Kiesling. Uh-huh. He and I have a very close relationship already, and we talk about the big picture in conversation with that board of directors. We meet with the board president and members of the board regularly to get advice from them and to work with them as a resource for expanding our capabilities and making connections across Lexington and beyond.
Well, there's something going on nationally I had to bring up because we can't talk about the arts without talking about this. And I'm just wondering if these federal funding cuts at the National Endowments for the Humanities and the arts both are affecting children's theater in some way.
The cuts at the NEA are definitely affecting children's theater across the country. At Lexington Children's Theater specifically, we got slightly lucky. I'm going to say glass half full here. Because the program that they funded for our most recent fiscal year was a tour of a play called Quetzali and the Comic Book Queen versus the Alebrije of Darkness. Bit of a mouthful to say. Fantastic new play that we had commissioned from playwright Alvar Rios. And that play, we'd gotten advice to request all of our funds for reimbursement before the deadlines, and we successfully got all the funds that we were promised from the NEA for that production. So in this fiscal year, no tangible harm was done. But we know planning our next budget, we can't rely on the funds that we used to be able to rely on. So that's going to affect us going forward.
Mm-hmm. That's a very familiar story.
Yeah.
Is it accurate to believe that children's theater is an integral part of a community's overall theatrical ecosystem? How does it fit in? How does it play a role?
The role of children's theater in Lexington and any community is that you want to develop young people into the habit of appreciating the arts when they're young. Now, appreciating the arts and building theater lovers and theater makers young, that's only one side of it, right? We believe that there's more of a benefit to coming to the theater, to taking theater classes, than arts for art's sake. By coming to these plays, children are learning things beyond their experiences. They're able to kind of practice the emotions and the conflicts that they might find in the future. In most cases, when we're preparing children for the future, we're only preparing them for what we know. But the arts and theater in specific gives children ways to prepare for something beyond their knowing. And I think that's really important.
Is it difficult in this day and age to work with young people who are so connected to devices and screens?
I actually think to some extent it means that they are desperately asking for this kind of analog experience. I found children light up when they realize that the actor is actually there. There's a physical person in the room with them, that there's no screen. And that being said, we can also use the language of technology, incorporate it into the work. Projections and media have been a big part of theater since the 70s at this point. And so we are able to use those tools just as well as the analog tools.
You know, many may be under the impression that since it's called children's theater, that it must be about productions put on by children. But it's much, much more than that, isn't it?
Yeah. At Lexington Children's Theater, we do have children on our stage.
Mm-hmm.
We have both children on our stage and we have professional adults performing for children. I always like to say that the term children's theater is not an exclusive term. It's not saying adults not welcome. It's just saying children are welcome. One of the really exciting examples of that kind of having children on stage, having children in the audience, is our summer family musical, which this year is Cinderella. And in the summer family musical, we've got children performing with adults, often entire family units, in the same rehearsal process on stage together. It's when I was getting ready for this role, that experience was really the thing that made me say that this was a special place. They don't have that at many other places.
Is that right? That's really interesting. What productions are on tap for this summer?
For the summer, well, we've got one more show from our last season, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. This is for the very young. It's only got two more performances, June 7th, June 14th. And then later in the summer, we've got Cinderella, the family musical I told you about. And coming down the pipeline, we got Stuart Little, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. That's our holiday show, obviously. And then the spring, we got The Princess Who Lost Her Hair, which is an African folktale, very excited about. We've got The Secret Garden. We've got Pinkalicious, which is our One Lexington, One Book collaboration, in which children be getting picture books along with seeing the play. And we've got Pinocchio, and we've got another theater for the very young play, Mariposa Butterfly, which is a bilingual production.
Wow, that is quite a lineup. That's incredible. Jeff Sachs, the new managing director at Lexington Children's Theater, thanks so much and good luck.
Thank you.
Greg Lind and Matt Page have stopped by Eastern Standard to tell us about a project they've been working on at Matt's studio outside Frankfurt and the result that's ready to be unveiled. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here, Tom.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Sitting with me here are a couple of masterful songwriting musicians, and I can attest to that, having worked with them on another project that will be coming out sometime in the future, and we might touch on that in just a bit, but today we're focusing on their new album, Lime Tree.
You say you're in love again,
This is the song Dweller at Lime Tree. So whoever wants to start this, what's it about? Who's the dweller and where is Lime Tree?
That's a great question. We had six songs demoed for the album, and that was seven. So went on vacation. I told Matt I was not coming back without a song, and I always keep notes and one-liners and things around, and I noticed a file called Dweller at Lime Tree, and I asked my wife and my son if it meant anything. They had no idea what I was talking about. So it became the song. So come back with it, record it. I think that was the transition. That was the time when it really sparked that we had something with the album. But it's just a song about love and relationships and times where you get stuck and you feel like you can't get out, but there's always a way out.
Well, I couldn't resist opening the conversation with that track. It's really something. There are more where that one came from. But before we go more deeply into the music, a quick backgrounder for listeners, if we could. Your day jobs. Who wants to go first? Greg, how about you?
I'm in sales. I handle for a package company, a ready-to-drink cocktail. So I'm in the booze business. So I handle regional chains nationally for them, and that's what I do Monday through Friday.
All right. How about you, Matt?
I am over at the University of Kentucky. I teach digital media and design over there, graphic design, and I'm the director of undergraduate studies, so I sort of oversee all of our undergraduate programs, and I love it. I've been there for like 15 years, and I couldn't ask for a better job. I love it there.
So who's doing what on this album?
Well, I'll say that, you know, I sing in another project, and I have a personal solo project, but when Greg and I got back together, it was really nice because I could step back just a little bit, because Greg has a beautiful voice and a wonderful way of writing songs that inspire me as a player and a musician. So he would come in with all the lyrics, the melodies, you know, the chord progressions, and say, okay, Matt, here's this thing I'm working on. And then I would sort of build it out from there, and we would talk about it and how we wanted to add to it and arrange it. But I think of them as like he plants the seeds, and then we sort of grow it together.
Well, now that you're churning them out, is there some sort of process? I know this is what everybody asks every artist, but is there a process or is it really more a matter of kind of grabbing a notepad and a recorder to capture ideas when they happen?
It's everything, anything and everything. There's inspiration everywhere. And a lot of songs, especially on the Lime Tree album, started with an acoustic. And now instead of a notepad, a phone with notes or a laptop, and kind of starts from there. Lately, for the next album, which we're getting really close to wrapping up the writing and the initial demoing for, it's been more of embracing the technology and the software. Logic Pro is what we utilize, and the session players and stuff. So sometimes it's a rhythm, sometimes it's music, it's in your head, or inspiration, words. It could be anything and everything, and that's the fun part of just keeping your eyes and ears and senses open for inspiration.
It was really tough to choose just a couple of tracks from the album. I think they're all great. I really do. But our time here is, of course, limited. And I want to ask you about one song that is kind of a departure from everything else. And that's titled Patrick Murphy. And it features a guest artist. We'll listen to a passage in just a moment. But first, if you would set it up for us, Greg, tell us about it.
Well, I'm a proud Kentuckian, born in Ashland, but I'm also a proud Irishman. So Kentucky Irish, both sides. My mom's McGuire, and of course, my dad's Lynn. They both, families immigrated from Ireland, and I love the culture, love the music, and always wanted to write an Irish song, a pub song, and an anthem, a sing-along with a pint or two in the pub, but I didn't want it to come off inauthentic at all. So I was always waiting for inspiration. Then I read a story about Patrick Murphy. He is a real person in Ireland. And prior to the horrific Russian invasion of the Ukraine, the Russian military, the Navy were outrunning maneuvers 150 miles off the coast of Ireland, which has been for generations Irish fishing grounds. And they initially tried to solve it diplomatically, which didn't work. So Patrick grabbed a couple fishermen and they did the 150 mile trek out there. And after a conversation, which I'm Irish, I know how the conversations could go. And within a matter of a short period of time, the whole Navy disappeared in the horizon. They just left. And I was like, that needs to be put to music. And that's Patrick Murphy.
Oh, Patrick Murphy of Castletown Bear. Led his fleet to Kamchatka brown bears. Turn around, turn around, turn around your war machines and hurry your asses back.
Matt, for you, what is this experience like working with Greg and working with this music?
As I'm sitting and listening to Greg, I remember something early on that we said, which is, you know, I think often with a creative project, you get together with people that you sort of, maybe you envision a sound, or maybe you think that there's something specific you're going for. And I remember early on with Greg, you know, we were talking and I said, listen, bring in anything and everything. We can make anything a song. I'll make anything into a song with you. And so that's kind of been our mantra, which is why I think maybe this first album, you know, you're talking about Patrick Murphy, and then you talk about a song like Dweller, and you talk about a song like Strays. They're all really different songs. And I think the unifying force there is, you know, Greg's spirit, his great voice, and then different kinds of approaches without really any fear or predetermined direction. And I think that for me as an artist has been really exciting, coming from other projects where we had a really specific vision. So this one is a very open, and again, just like, you know, meeting you and then saying, hey, you know, Tom likes this stuff too. Like, we've got some new material. Like, what if Tom wants to play on some of this stuff? And like, to be able to do that with the project and invite lots of different perspectives and people into it, I think that's very different from what we did when we were much younger. So I think it's really exciting to be here with Greg talking with you. You know, like, this is like, you know, you just, like in life, you just don't know where creative journeys are going to go. And all of a sudden you find yourself in a place you just didn't expect.
Yeah. And I mean, this started out on Sundays at your place, laying down tracks.
Exactly.
It's been such a pleasure talking with you two, and even more so having that opportunity to do some recording. Absolutely. With you. Maybe we'll be talking about that down the road a bit.
I hope so.
Yes.
Where can the new album, Lime Tree, be found and heard?
I mean, you know, I think most people are pretty savvy these days. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. Those are probably our two, you know, main places to go find us. So Lynn Page, I can't remember all the exact handles, but you look for, you know, Lynn Page, Lime Tree, and you will find us. We've got, you know, a good distributor who gets it out everywhere. We're on all the major streaming services. And of course, I always love to hear from people. So I respond. If you write to us, you'll get a response from either Greg or I. Yeah.
Okay. And listener, just so you know, that's L-Y-N-D for
L-Y-N-D,
Lynn.
Yes.
And P-A-G-E for Page.
Correct. Yes. Thank you.
Well, Greg Lynn, Matt Page, out with a new album, Lime Tree. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
They turn around their war machines and hurried their asses back home.
Fusion music. What is fusion music? Well, that's when you combine two different styles of music that already exist to create something new. Maybe you've heard of jazz fusion. That's a blending of jazz and rock music. Weather Report really kicked that into high gear more than 50 years ago. Coming to the Lyric Theater on June 14th is a fusion of the classical music and dance of India and other forms, beats and rhythms of world music. It's presented by Green Room Exchange, Lexington's nonprofit cultural exchange organization that has so far treated us to the music of Cuba, Senegal, Japan, Haiti, Spain, Argentina, and the Bluegrass Indo-American Civic Society. And with us here in the studio are Green Room's Lee Carroll and Lexington artist, performer, and choreographer Lakshmi Sriraman. Thank you both for stopping by.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
So, Lee, first, if you would begin this by telling us more about what's happening at the Lyric on June 14th.
And we're very excited. For the first time, we'll be presenting music from the Indian subcontinent, Gandharva. I had the opportunity to hear them perform last year at Loudon House at a small concert, and immediately it's like, Green Room needs to put on this show. So this is our opportunity not just to present classical Indian music and dance and incorporate music from around the world, a fusion of musical ideas at the Lyric Theater.
Well, this is going to be a real opportunity for listeners in this area to experience something really interesting and exotic. And we're getting a little bit of a taste of that right here in the studio, because Lee and I are realizing that in our American English, we can't quite pronounce the name of this event properly. So, Lakshmi, will you do the honors? What do you call it?
Actually, Lee, you did a pretty good job. It's Gandharva. Gandharva actually means celestial musicians. So the name is very beautiful, and amazing is the ensemble. And they are going to be taking music that's rooted in Indian traditions and adding layers of world music. So if you have listened to any kind of world music, you will hear tonalities and all that layered and blended together. And it's actually, I've not heard them in this format before, so I'm looking forward to it.
And there's a dance element to this as well, correct?
Right. So Sri School of Dance, that's a dance school that I run. Mm-hmm. We are curating and I'm choreographing and presenting all the dances from different regions in India. So these dances will look like very different. And they are going to be singing and providing orchestra for it live on stage. So it's quite a big undertaking. And Lee won't tell you this, but Lee is also part of the ensemble as they present here. He is going to be adding his amazing mastery of jazz along with the music that's going to be created there.
Okay. As another teaser for the listener, we're doing this about a month out. We're a month away from the performance. So where are you with that, Lee? Are you ready? Or are you going to be working on stuff?
They're going to give me recordings of the music and give me the freedom to apply what I think is appropriate for it.
Okay.
You asked me earlier, you know, I'm going to play piano or what mm-hmm. am I going to do? I don't know yet until I hear the music, but I will respond to what I hear. There's a point I think I need to bring up. And I have this problem when we go to Africa and talk about Africa. Africa is an enormous place mm-hmm. with a tremendous variety of cultures. I don't think we in the West generally understand the tremendous difference between the music of North India and South India. And I'm sure there's a lot more complexity than that. And this will be an opportunity for the folks in Lexington to get a sense of the tremendous variety of music.
I think it will also be an opportunity to get a sense of the size of the Indian community in Lexington, which is pretty formidable, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's also grown beyond Lexington. So people, the Indian origin, people who come to participate in festivals or music festivals, programs and such, go beyond just Lexington. It's a whole bioregion, so the whole bluegrass region. And sometimes when the program is really good, we get audiences from Louisville and Cincinnati. So we are doing some really very good art here in Lexington.
Lakshmi, your website tells us that you're dedicated to using art to tackle social issues, to foster dialogue, to build communities. In your mind, how can art do that? How can art accomplish those things, especially in these times?
Especially in these times, we have to do that. That's our mandate, I think. We have to leverage art to reach across borders, reach across divides, and get into a conversation that's beyond all these man-made divisions that we have somehow structurally built into every infrastructure and every part of the system we have around us. And specifically to your question, when I listen to a music that I have not been familiar with or something that I didn't grow up listening to, I don't think of how different it is. I only think, oh my God, this is amazing. And then I think, where does it come from? And what is the culture behind it? That becomes the second question. The direct point of entry is, this is amazing. And I think that is the power of art. And I think we are all called to activate that. And in my own work, actually, as part of this performance also on June 14th, I'm going to be performing in collaboration with Dr. Shauna Morgan, who has Indian heritage. She is going to be reciting a poetry, and I'm going to be moving to it, and we are going to have the ensemble play music, and I'm going to be moving to that. So it's going to be music, poetry, and dance all created, all under the theme of women empowerment. So that's how we can bring, even on a stage such as this, questions that we all need to ask ourselves.
How did this happen? What made this fusion occur?
This ensemble, now called Gandharva because it has more artists in it, the core musicians of this group, I have been working with them since 2009. They have been playing for my dance. They have recorded music for me. They have played for my students' performances and so on and so forth. And while they accompany dancers, they are amazing musicians in their own rights. Back home in India, they are much celebrated artists. They are the best of the best artists. And so every time they would come here, I would seek to arrange like a house concert or a very intimate gathering where people could listen to them. And I've always wanted to bring their music to the larger Lexington area. And when I started working with Green Room Exchange, I was like, this is the right match.
Will any of your students be performing?
Yes. Yes.
Good experience for them.
Yes.
So again, it's on June 14th at the Lyric Theater. What about tickets? How can they be obtained?
They can get tickets on our website, www.greenroomexchange.org. Or they can go to the Lyric Theater, Google that, and check the events, and you can buy tickets.
Lakshmi Sriraman and Lee Carroll, thank you so much for giving us a heads up about this event. It really sounds fascinating.
Well, thanks for having us on.
We certainly hope so.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, Studio Dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions are on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.